it's almost too on the nose, where each of the Jaegers are stereotypically their nations, like the Chinese dragon and the poor Russians, like they're Ivan Drago's. They're in a Cold War era tank. It's like, you know, if I was a Russian today, I'd be like, can we get past that image of us, please?
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum.
And Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and even the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is brought to you by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Whether you're looking for your dream home, a savvy investment property, or expert guidance in home rehab and flipping, the Zach Pack has you covered. Check the link in the show notes for more information.
We always thought alien life would come from the stars, but it came from deep beneath the Pacific.
What the hell is going on?
The first kaiju made land in San Francisco. The second attack hit Manila. Then the third one hit Cabo. Then we learned this was not going to stop. In order to fight monsters, we created monsters of our own. A new weapon. The Jaeger program was born. Two pilots, our minds, our memories, connected. And man and machine become one.
Edge of our hope. At the end of our time, we've chosen to believe in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
It is pretty cool.
Pacific Rim.
All right, we are doing it. Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim, and who better to join us on this episode but Sean Childers.
Hello.
Hello. Sean, welcome back, first of all.
Number three. Not that I'm counting or anything.
That's right. I forget about Tusk.
Oh, how can you forget, about,
forget about Tusk? Yeah. Exactly. Especially considering that today we have to say rest in peace, Grace Smith, Kevin Smith's mother. So.
Oh. I was not aware, man.
Yeah, she apparently died last night after lots of complications. So, rest in peace, Grace.
Yeah.
Rest in peace.
Influenced a seminal filmmaker, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But how you guys doing?
Doing all right.
Yeah.
It's been a long work week, and it's only Tuesday.
I feel that.
Yeah, it's December. The holidays are coming up, which is like a great time of year. It's very festive. It's very cold and snowy. I feel like everybody I know is like not 100% health-wise, you know? I would say I'm like 90%, so I'm not terrible, but As Sean said, the kaiju crud is out there. It's affecting a lot of people.
Indeed. Sean, is it cold and snowy where you are?
No, it is not. It's just miserable. Just nothing but sun and darkness.
Oh, wow.
I know that completely goes against each other, but still, no, it's just really, really hot here.
Where are you, Sean?
I'm over in Florida. I'm technically in Central Florida, but I live in the middle of nowhere in Florida.
Wow. It actually looks like you're recording in like the middle of a swamp right now, like deep in the Everglades. There's like nothing behind you. Like...
Never find me.
Sean's off the grid.
Yeah. There'll be some gators in the background throughout the recording.
I live on a retirement community where they used to have a golf course and all the golf courses were filled in.
Oh, man.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Sean, you are the host of a podcast yourself. Would you mind telling us about that?
Yes. And if you don't mind, I'm going to intro it real quick. My name is Sean, a.k.a. Kensuketti, and I have a podcast known as Big Mecha, but not huge. It's where I host it with a couple of my buddies and sometimes some special guests, Vincent, where we talk and rate and review different mecha and mecha-related things like Transformers, Pacific Rim, more Transformers, and then also upcoming Real Steel.
Yeah. So cool. I was guest hosting, thank you, Sean, on an episode. You guys were talking about Transformers, the animated movie.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it the Transformers, the movie?
Yeah, Transformers, the movie. I hate their naming convention.
When does that episode drop?
Good question. I still need to edit. But we are actually in the process of finishing season 2. That final episode of season 2 comes out this week. And originally we were going to have Transformers movie 5, The Last Night, come out. But that movie is... The best I could say is it's atrocious. So we were recording it. We reviewed it. And unfortunately, my computer decided that it didn't want to save any of that. So It's just not going to go up. So instead, we've decided to have our final episode being the newest mecha anime that came out, Mobile Suit Gundam G-Quux, where it's the final episode where we talk and rate the finale. So tune in for that.
That's awesome. That's not exactly my niche, but I love mechas when they show up in my monster movies. So yeah, I can't wait to listen to all that you got going on your own pod.
Thank you.
Let's just get to some quick nuts and bolts here. Thank you for hanging out with us, friends, dear listeners, all over the world, in the Midwest, in Florida, wherever you are. Go ahead and rate and review Camp Kaiju wherever you're listening. You can follow us on patreon.com/Camp Kaiju for all sorts of things. I'm kind of just, you know, after this recording, I'm going to record a little behind the scenes video just talking about some things we got in the works. You can find more typed reviews and merchandise discounts. Otherwise, you can get in touch with us, me and Matt. You can reach us at campkaiju@gmail.com, campkaijupodcast.com, Instagram, or our voicemail number, 612-470-2612. And back to Patreon. Thank you, our wonderful Patreon supporters, Jason, Chris, Sean Childers in the house, Peggy, our anonymous patron, and a new member of our ranks, Superfan Don, has made the leap to become a Patreon supporter. Thank you, Don.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you, Don.
Yeah, and we've got some comments from Don later on about our giant spider invasion episode. So stick around, listeners, to at least the halfway point of this episode.
But then you can stop after the halfway point. No need to finish it out.
No, this entire episode's just going to be a Tusk redo. So,
Oh,
I'm not prepared for that.
Hey, that was a popular episode. You go back in the data. It connected with people.
I'm not surprised.
All right, so this episode here, Pacific Rim, will be dropping in December of 2025. Folks, listeners, sign up at Patreon at any point in time and history. But if you do so in the next few weeks before 2026, we will send you a tote bag, TBD on the details of that. But it'll be a bag that you can tote things in. And stay tuned for some additional features in 2026, maybe a Zoom happy hour with that.
I guess you could say that's totally cool.
Nice.
All right. I can put that on the bag, maybe. I'll customize it. If people want to sign up for Patreon, you know, it's worth it. Sean, if you have an idea.
I have ideas, but you won't want them right now.
All right. You will put a pin in that one.
It's just going to be my face doing the walrus, you know. Ah! So.
Unrated bonus footage.
Yes.
Matt, you want to talk about what's coming up on Camp Kaiju?
Yeah, so coming up soon is our annual holiday/season announcement for our next season of Camp Kaiju. This is always one of my favorite episodes of the year. It's a good excuse for, you know, not only me and Vincent, but also like all of our guest stars throughout the year to join us for a little holiday happy hour, maybe drink some eggnog and talk about what's coming up on the next season of Camp Kaiju. So check that out for a sneak preview of all the episodes. 12 episodes, right? That we'll be talking about in the next season of Camp Kaiju.
6 from you, 6 from me. That episode will be dropping at the end of the year here in 2025. Past guest stars, as well as our Patreon supporters. And who do we have signed up so far for this special action-packed episode? We have Sean Childers in the house. He's going to be back.
Darn tootin'. Sean
Pryor hopes to be there. Our other favorite Sean and Beth Breadlaw, who featured on our Ebera Horror of the Deep episode. So that's cool. It's like, you know, a who's who of the past. We got some deep cuts. You know, if you didn't catch Beth's episode, go back and catch that one. But yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
I'm excited to meet some people.
And that's just it. Yeah, I like fostering that community so we can all nerd out together.
Exactly.
Yeah, that'll be great. I'm glad we didn't criticize Ebera too much to dissuade Beth from coming back for the holiday episode.
I think she still likes us, so cool. That's a win.
Yeah, that's good. That's good to hear.
All right. Let's get into this big, bad mamma jamma of a film, Pacific Rim. What are our personal histories with this movie? Sean, let's hear from you first.
I saw this movie on release for my birthday when it came out. Not only that, I saw it multiple times in theaters. I bought the Blu-ray when it came out. I got the 4K edition. I got the big giant box that has part of Gypsy Danger on the front where it's like a plastic shell. It's it's my lifeblood. I obviously spoilers, but this is my top tier movie. So, you know, sorry, but yeah, I just love this movie. This movie's so good on so many levels, whether it's as cheesy as it wants to be or whether it's, you know, super serious, but you can tell that they're trying to like not crack a smile. It's just, I love it.
Yeah, I think you're not alone in that sentiment. That's for sure.
I also saw this movie upon release for my birthday. When is your birthday, Sean?
July 15th.
Okay. Mine is July 24th, so I think I waited a week after it came out, and then I saw it back in 2013. But after that, which was great. It was a great birthday movie, you know, a summer blockbuster, obviously, so much fun. After that, though, I feel like my experience with the Pacific Rim was totally different than yours, Sean, because that is the only time I had seen this movie up until yesterday again.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I liked it. I hadn't seen it in a while. Good to revisit it. I, you know, another spoiler, I don't know if I like it as much as Sean, but that is a difficult bar to hit, you know?
Yeah, I put the tears up there pretty high.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm in the middle with you guys, but I did not see it when it came out. I hadn't even heard of it.
How do we remove Vincent from this?
Yeah.
This is my show.
Sean is the host now.
We don't need that. Trust me, you don't.
No, I'm thinking about where I was in 2013. That was a weird year for me. I was going to college, but also kind of part-time, and I just really wasn't going to the movies a lot. I had other things going on. But it must have been the year after or 2 years later. I saw it at home. My brother had the DVD. I fell in love with it at the time. I've seen it a few times since. Last night I watched it with the audio commentary from Del Toro.
Mm.
which was a real treat. And most of my notes tonight, A, came from the wiki, but I recognized that wiki from the audio commentary. So my notes, wiki notes, they're all from Del Toro's mouth, which, you know, that sounds weird, but
I was going to say, did you manage to get like a little puppet of him and you record it or something? Or
this episode is dedicated to Del Toro's mouth. Sean, you are our resident mecha expert.
I wouldn't say that I'm an expert, but I delve into it.
You dabble. What could you speak to the origins and the legacy of the mecha genre?
Now, let me try to find my bifocals here. All right. So without reading too much into it, basically the mecha genre is where you've got giant robots that look like humanoid type creations that generally go against either, you know, other creatures or other giant sized robots. And they're all usually piloted either by one or sometimes two people. But if you get into the super robot genre, sometimes you get combiners that end up having three or more. Based on the wiki, what it says here is that the first thing that we ended up getting was a 1940s short manga called Electric Octopus. And then from there, we ended up moving into an actual mecha series that was created as a manga first by Mitsutero Yokoyama called Tetsujin 28. We ended up seeing a bunch of different things that come after that. But the biggest thing that happened right after that was in 72, where author Go Nagai, who is huge in the manga and anime world, he ended up creating something called Mazinger Z, which is considered the first super robot. And that is a wild show. Hell is involved. Giant creatures are involved. Multiple pilots that just start screaming, thinking about the hot-bloodedness of everything. It's just so good. This came out in the 70s, so this is like predates even Dragon Ball Z doing that type of thing.
Wow.
Then you get into like even more super robot stuff, but then the biggest thing that came out was in 1979, Yoshiyuki Tomino ended up creating Mobile Suit Gundam, which they don't consider as super robot. They actually consider that as like the real robot series, where it's basically taking a bunch of different stories, usually political-based or war-based, and then creating basically just giant war stories or, you know, different, can't think of the word, basically just creating these giant war stories that involve just these giant robots, but they seem real enough that you're like, oh man, I could see this happening. I don't want it to happen because that would ruin everybody and everything, but it just blew up from there. And then if we skip ahead a bunch of years, we end up getting video games like Armored Core. Armored Core is where you just pilot giant mechs taking on other giant mechs. Or, you know, in the latest one, I think you go against something that's as big as an AT-AT from Star Wars. And it's just insane. But probably the biggest thing that a lot of people will either love or hate is Neon Genesis Evangelion, which basically blends psychological and religious influences into the mecha genre, and you get this giant messed up, I don't even want to say that we'll go with it, giant messed up masterpiece. It's just bonkers. But anyways, Pacific Rim, yeah.
Do you have a favorite of the mecha subgenre aside from Pacific Rim?
Yes, and it's gonna sound weird considering what I'm about to say. There is a show that I absolutely love, and I've talked about this before on here. It's called a Dual Parallel Trouble Adventure. It's basically the harem genre, where it's all these women loving this one dude, but combine it with a sci-fi theme where it splits realities. You got one, you know, him going from one era to another, going universe hopping, and then all of a sudden there's a giant robot that's the cause of everything.
Whoa.
Wow.
Only 12 episodes, but it's so good.
There are so many shows you mentioned that just sound so insane in the best ways.
Honestly, some of the Gundam ones are, like, even though they're older, they're really approachable because it's very mature. It's not like something where You can sit down. They do have these, but they don't really have Gundam with kids in mind, even though it was generally broadcast for like teenagers and young adults. It's very, very adult oriented, not like in terms of sex, but in terms of just the sheer amount of horrific wartime violence. It's honestly a really good watch.
Cool.
Would you say that Ultraman is part of the mecha genre?
Good question. So, no, that is considered part of the tokusatsu genre, which we will be covering under Toku for Two, my other podcast. But there is a sub show or sub series from Ultraman called Gridman, which, if you remember from in the early 90s when Power Rangers came out, there was another show that tried to compete with it called Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad. Now, I believe that was Matthew, I forget his name. Anyways, he was on Blossom at some point, I think. It was basically Ultraman inside of a computer fighting kaiju, but then his best friends would power him up by jumping into the computer and forming giant armor pieces that basically transform, turning him into a robot. Since then, they've actually managed to make two anime series and a movie called SSSS Gridman and SSSS Dinozanon and Gridman Universe, where it basically combines it all, and they even allude to the original Gridman show and Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad all together.
Wow. That's awesome. I like the Ultraman that I've seen, which is not very much. Vincent and I saw Shin Ultraman a couple years ago, which I thought was fantastic. Yeah,
so good.
I've always been curious, like, what exact subgenre that fits into. So that's very helpful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, tokusatsu. It's weird with tokusatsu because with kaiju and everything else involving Godzilla, you know, you would consider that like Suitmation, but then you got Power Rangers that come in and do the exact same thing, but on a smaller scale. And then you got the whole Sentai genre. Then you've got Kamen Rider. Kamen Rider doesn't really use mecha, but they end up doing the whole thing with, you know, different suits, different transformations, as they call henshins. And then from there on, it just balloons into so many different things.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I know that was a lot. Sorry.
No, I went on a magic carpet ride there listening to you talk about this rabbit hole that kept getting deeper and deeper.
Why do you think I have these podcasts now? So I can do it. So I can finally watch everything.
You know, the monster movie umbrella is as massive as that too. And I've nerded out. I've like done a whole diagram, like on a big piece of paper, like a spider web of all the offshoot subgenres of monster movies. Maybe that's something I'll share for patrons. Yeah, because there's just so many.
So many.
Oh, Del Toro on his audio commentary was commenting on the Japanese relationship to technology versus the American relationship for technology. And in his words, he was saying Americans generally fear technology, but the Japanese really embrace it. And that has allowed them in their pop culture to turn mechas into almost godlike beings and infuse them with a mythology.
Mm-hmm.
I just found that pretty interesting because the mecha genre, it's not an American thing. Like, if we have it, it's only because we borrow from the Japanese.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of different adaptations that we have, too. Did you ever get around to watching the Scarlett Johansson Ghost in the Shell movie?
No. I did not hear good things. And
yeah.
I will say this, not as a defender of all the things that people are rightfully upset about. It's an okay movie. It's worth a watch just once. But the whole thing about it is technology is fully advanced to the point where people embrace it and transcend. And that's all I'm going to leave you with.
Okay. I like stuff like that.
This summer, our world will come under attack.
The mayor has declared a state of emergency.
By the most evil force ever known. He has armies at his command. And only one power on Earth can stop him. Welcome to my nightmare. Now, the ultimate adventure begins.
Hi, honey. Hello.
You garlic-sucking dingo brain!
Oh,
for the Power Rangers.
Ooh, where's my autograph book?
More action. More adventure. More power.
Yours is back.
You lose, you lose.
Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the movie. It's a new age of combat.
Human beings, genetically engineered to be the best fighters in history.
Two champions.
It isn't over until someone wins.
At war with each other.
Achilles, I have already killed you.
Two invincible men.
Let's finish it, Alexander, here and now.
The ultimate killing machines.
I'm gonna get in this thing, and I'm gonna kick your...
Robot Jocks. Ladies and gentlemen, over the years, Toonami's given you some of the greatest cartoon shows ever made. Now we're proud to present our newest edition, a program about love, honor, sacrifice, revenge, and a whole lot of destruction. Let's get things started. Gundam fight all set, ready, go!
I will get rid of them with my own hands.
Your crime shall not go unpunished.
Premiering next Monday at 5, only Toonami.
Guillermo del Toro, his first feature was Chronos back in 1993, I think, which was a good introduction to kind of like his style and his thematic interests. It's sort of a Frankenstein-Dracula hybrid with like some themes about, you know, like gothic horror is in there, like strange contraptions, you know, the undead, life beyond death, things like that. He was kind of like one of the trio of Mexican filmmakers who rose to prominence in the 1990s, along with Alfonso Cuarón and Alejandro González Iñárritu. So del Toro, very much a horror director. We've talked about Mimic on the podcast before. Maybe not his best movie, but certainly a very interesting movie, I would say. You know, he's very versatile. He has continued to make movies in both Mexico and Spain. I believe The Devil's Backbone was made in Spain. I think Pan's Labyrinth was kind of an international co-production with both Spain and Mexico. He's made a lot of movies in Hollywood, too, Frankenstein being the most recent example of that. He made Pinocchio for Netflix a couple years ago as well.
Nightmare Alley.
Nightmare Alley, yeah, one of my favorites. I really liked the Nightmare Alley remake a lot. Crimson Peak is another one. You know, Blade 2, that was kind of like one of his first big Hollywood movies. The Hellboy movies, he directed those as well. So definitely a good example of a Hollywood director who also makes movies outside of Hollywood and is able to inject a lot of personality, a lot of artistry and imagination into, you know, like Pacific Rim, even big budget mainstream Hollywood movies. And, I think from my own personal perspective, I think you see like the fanboy love for like the genres and the like previous influences that he's paying homage to. But, you know, there's depth to it. There's like always an attempt to kind of like add to it and make it his own. So really a unique kind of eclectic director.
The only film of his I haven't seen other than Frankenstein, shame, but maybe by the time this releases, I'll have seen it, is Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. Other than that, I have seen all of his movies. Generally big fan because what you say, I love his, he not only honors the genres he's working in, but he does really try to make them his own too. Related to that, Del Toro wanted in Pacific Rim, he wanted to honor the kaiju and mecha genres of his youth. He states he grew up watching tokusatsu and Godzilla movies in the 1960s in Mexico. And he said, quote, he wanted to be conscious of the heritage, but not a pastiche or an homage or greatest hits of everything. I didn't want to be postmodern or referential. I just belong to a genre. I really wanted to create something new, something madly in love with those things. I tried to bring epic beauty to it and drama and operatic grandeur. So, yeah, just speaking to that individuality in his films.
You know, he's like a humanist director. He seems to like people. He cares about his characters. The Shape of Water is another big movie that I forgot to mention, but I think that's one of the best examples of that, where it's kind of an homage to Creature from the Black Lagoon, but very much a romantic movie with a lot of compassion for the characters. And I think, you know, I might have some criticisms about this, but I think we see that in Pacific Rim as well, where, you know, the characters have tragic backstories. They have things that they're trying to overcome, and it's kind of a pacifist, humanistic movie, even though it's about mechas fighting kaijus, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely, which makes it the second one all the more sad, even though I still enjoy it. The second one is a sharp turn from what this movie is.
Mm. Ooh, I've only seen it once. I don't quite remember it as well. Perhaps, you know, well,
I see what you're hinting at.
I won't review Pacific Rim Uprising. As decent as it is, I think it's only decent.
And I've never seen it, so I'll have to add that to the list. Now would be a good time to do so.
It's basically Pacific Rim The Next Generation. Just take all the kids from Degrassi and put them in giant mecha.
That sounds kind of terrible, to be honest, but I'll still give it a try.
What about the ever lovable Atlantic Rim? That's from The Asylum. It's a pretty bad movie.
Kind of intrigued to watch that also.
Yeah, I saw that years ago. MST3K did episode on it with their revamped series.
It might be the best way for me to watch it then.
Honestly. Years ago, Guillermo del Toro was touring an exhibition of his private collection of monster movie memorabilia and props from his films. And at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, this thing had a residency for like 6 months. And I went to that. The only movie I had seen up until that point of his was Pacific Rim. And I felt like such a dweeb because that's not his like most well-known movie. I hadn't even seen Pan's Labyrinth. And my friend was like, Vince, what? Pacific Rim's the only Del Toro film you've seen?
I still haven't either.
What?
Pan's Labyrinth?
I haven't watched it
yet. You haven't seen Pan's Labyrinth?
I own it on DVD and I have not watched it yet.
Oh.
It's part of the ever-increasing backlog.
You should change that immediately.
I mean, when you're stuck watching the Transformers original animated movie three times in a week.
No, I get it. Trust me, I get it. Same cinematographer as Pacific Rim. Guillermo Navarro also shot Del Toro's The Devil's Backbone, Kronos, and Hellboy. And Navarro won the Oscar for Best Cinematography for Pan's Labyrinth.
I feel like the phrase dark fairy tale is like epitomized by Pan's Labyrinth. Like that phrase was meant to define that movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's pretty dark.
Yeah, very, very good.
The screenplay of Pacific Rim is co-written by Del Toro and Travis Beecham. The story is by Travis Beecham. The biggest other credit I saw to his name was Clash of the Titans from 2010. Very much in the same vein as Pacific Rim in terms of epic mythological monsters, but ultimately very different.
Was that the one with Liam Neeson where he goes, release the Kraken?
Yes.
Okay.
So maybe Beecham has a knack for epic one-liners. Release the Kraken. Today we are canceling the apocalypse. Let's talk about the select cast.
First off, this is my introduction to Rinko Kikuchi. She did the role fantastically. I loved every moment that she was on screen where you could actually like see everything that they were trying to like have a Raleigh nitpick with her, where she's constantly judging him and everything about her personality. And then the way that she was able to display all that, wonderful. But one thing that you may not know is that she was actually in a movie called Kumiko I think it's Kumiko the Wanderer or Kumiko the Hunter. Everyone knows the movie Fargo, right?
Yeah.
So this movie is about a woman who went searching for the missing money of Fargo. And it's apparently based on a true story where she actually went looking for it. And so it's basically kind of like a biopic about that. But yeah, I saw that and it was fantastic.
What's it called?
I think it's Kumiko the Treasure Hunter. I've seen that as well. It is very, very good. I like that movie a lot too.
Yes.
Cool.
And you can't find it digitally.
Hmm.
You actually have to rent it or buy it physically now.
I didn't know that. I always kind of like that when that happens. Like, it can be inconvenient, like if you're just trying to find it on streaming. But as somebody who likes physical media, I kind of appreciate it when that happens.
Oh, yeah. I had to get mine through Amazon as soon as I saw that it was at least one copy available. So it was worth it.
Cool. So Idris Elba plays Marshall Stacker Pentecost. He's kind of the no-nonsense head of the operation who is leading the charge to, you know, lead the Jaeger fight against the Kaijus. So highly respected military leader who has dedicated his life to defending humanity from the Kaiju. I could have just read that off the Google Doc. That would have been a lot easier. Sorry about that. But yeah, Idris Elba, huge fan. I think I first saw him in The Wire, as a lot of other, at least American audiences did. He played Stringer Bell, very kind of intense, sort of frightening, but also complex and in some ways admirable character in that show. He's been in a lot of movies and TV shows. Some of the films that he's been in include 28 Weeks Later, American Gangster. He's one of the voices in Zootopia 2, so you can hear him out in theaters right now. He's in some other TV shows as well, like Luther. He had a memorable sort of guest starring role on The Office in addition to that. But yeah, again, like I always know him as Stringer Bell, and it's still kind of weird to me to see him in like fun roles. Pacific Rim is kind of a fun role, but he's still like a no-nonsense sort of tough guy character in some ways, but still very, very different than his role on The Wire. And he always, you know, just like a sense of gravity, a sense of sort of like weight and complexity to the characters he plays. I don't know if that's true of Zootopia 2 as well, but I think you could say that of Marshall in Pacific Rim.
So let me ask you this. Considering how old The Wire is, in this day and age, would you recommend The Wire to somebody who is not aware of it?
Yes, that's my favorite TV show of all time. It's the most complex TV show I think that's ever been made. I think it's, you know, it's about the city of Baltimore and like practically every social structure in that city, the police, the drug trade, healthcare, education, news. It's, yeah, like that is my favorite show. Mm. It's brilliant. And, you know, Idris Elba is only one of like a huge ensemble cast of characters, but I would say maybe the most memorable character on that show, which is saying a lot.
Nice.
See, now it's my time to hang my head in shame. I've never seen The Wire.
Me neither, so it's all right.
Wow. Amazing. I love it. I'll watch some mecha movies and TV shows, and I hope that you guys watch The Wire as well. That's my recommendation.
That's great. Deal.
I'm busy watching 80s Twilight Zone right now, so it's going to have to be a pass for now.
That's fair, yeah.
Love that, too. Yeah. I'll talk about Charlie Hunnam, not Hannum. But it is strange seeing his last name and being like, oh, that's so close to mine. I'm still the most famous Hannum. Gotcha, Charlie. He plays Raleigh Beckett, a former Jaeger pilot who's called back into action after his brother is killed in battle. This is early on in the film, so it's very much a survivor's guilt story of redemption for Raleigh. He's kind of the new guy on the squad. Well, he's the old guy, but you know, it's kind of, you know, what he's getting into is a few years have progressed. So he's got something to prove to the others. Del Toro talked a lot about approaching Pacific Rim as a sports drama.
Hmm.
And throughout it, he makes the comparison of like Raleigh, he's the new guy on the team. He has to prove himself. The team has to come together. Oh, there's like that locker room fight that always happens. They lose their first game only to come back and win the championship ultimately. And I totally buy it. So I find that an interesting take from Del Toro. And that's what I mean. Like his mind just thinks about these things in a different way. And like, how can I put my own spin on it? I'll think of it as a boxing movie or a baseball movie or something.
That's honestly a really perfect analogy. Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So that's Charlie Hunnam. We have Charlie Day. He plays a supporting character. He plays Dr. Newt Geisler, an eccentric and brilliant scientist obsessed with studying the kaiju. And we have Ron Perlman, a longtime collaborator with Del Toro. Even back in Kronos, Ron Perlman has a part. And he plays a character called Hannibal Chow, who is a black market, a black marketeer who makes a living dealing kaiju organs. Yeah, a pretty fun character, over the top. All the supporting characters are pretty over the top, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
they all lean in one direction, and they go hard with it.
Totally. And like, I think especially the Charlie Day and the Ron Perlman characters, as well as Newt's like partner in crime, played by Burt Gorman, I think is the name. Burn Gorman, is that right?
Burn Gorman.
Yeah, those three especially. Some of the other supporting characters are, in my opinion, are kind of like stock, you know, soldier tough guy type things. But those three definitely lend a lot of like pizzazz to the movie. Not that it needs any more of it, but you know.
So it's funny that you bring up Burn Gorman. If anybody's a fan of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, there was an episode where Charlie basically does his own Flowers for Algernon type thing. And Burn Gorman is the scientist that they bring because of the fact that they had the relation from this particular movie.
That's awesome.
I read that Guillermo del Toro also had like a very small cameo in some It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia stuff. I feel like it was like spinoff, though. Does that sound familiar? Are you guys Always Sunny fans?
That's interesting. I need to look that up.
I don't know. Del Toro did an FX show called The Strain.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe FX Fox was just trying to do like a little cross promotion. I don't know. That's pure conjecture on my part.
That could be. I'm going to try to find this because I thought it was really interesting, but please feel free to go on without me.
Yeah, no worries. I'll talk about a little bit more of the casting. Del Toro really wanted to play with archetypes in this movie. He wanted to, again, honor the original media that he was watching as a kid and that we all love. So if you watch an old Godzilla movie or a 50s American sci-fi movie, you're going to have the Charlie Hunnam character. You're going to have the Pentecost character. The young woman trying to prove herself as an independent woman. And like the kooky scientist characters. Del Toro said, you know, he doesn't want to put Charlie Day in just like a lab coat and goggles. He wants to have him have tattoos and Buddy Holly glasses. So like you get the idea that this is the stock character of kooky scientist, but clearly with a spin on it. So that was the DNA throughout a lot of the casting choices. Yeah. I could listen to Del Toro talk all day. It was really great. And also like mind numbing sometimes because he is so particular about every single choice. Everything in this movie was a choice. Every color, every lighting aspect. So to hear him wax on about his own movie, it was like you need a break after that because he goes deep.
This is why I need Matt to watch the second one because it's completely different.
Right.
I bet. Yeah. Yeah. Without Del Toro like in the director's chair, I feel like this movie too would be completely different, you know?
Oh, absolutely. In the second movie, this isn't spoiling anything, but as you mentioned, how in the first movie, Del Toro makes everything a specific choice. In this one, they kind of just go throw something at the wall and see if it sticks. And there's a scene where it's supposedly a montage type deal. But then after going through all the different things that they need to do, they just focus on two characters just standing there and talking. You can't hear what they're saying. And there's nothing really going on in the background. It's just basically almost like a static image. And they're playing the Pacific Rim theme. And they hold that shot for like 20 seconds. And then until the beat ends, they just keep it. It's like, why? Just, I like that movie, but come on.
Get on with it.
Wow. I read an interview with Del Toro where he said that like he doesn't really like there's like a second unit and like a third unit and maybe like, you know, B-roll footage and stuff like that. But he's there for all of that. Like he doesn't let anybody else like direct anything without his input or like his awareness, which I just think speaks to what you said. And I read that he had, you know, he works 17 or 18 hours a day, like 7 days a week for like most of the shooting schedule of the film. So, you know, yeah, that all just backs up what you said. Like he is the vision of the film and has a hand in all of it.
He did more like kind of outsource the beginning of Pacific Rim. There's a prologue with a lot of found footage, newscasts and whatnot, just setting the scene of this invasion from the ocean and the kaiju coming up. And Del Toro, again, on the commentary, he did have a friend of his direct those found footage moments because he admitted... Yeah, well, he kind of gave himself a backhanded compliment. He said, I could do a lot of things, but I can't do found footage. or he might have said, I'm really good at a lot of things, but not found footage. And I was like, yeah, man, feel yourself. But pass it off, too. Like, he does recognize, you know, I'm not good at that.
That's cool.
And I like those moments. I really like the prologue. It establishes a world. It's starting to lay some foundational rules for this world, like what we're dealing with, what culture, what the culture within the world is how they're approaching the monsters.
By the way, I did confirm that Guillermo del Toro plays Pappy McPoyle on 2 episodes.
That
of It's
was
Always
him.
Sunny
oh my God. Yeah. All right. I remember that exact one. There was a moment where he's in a courtroom and he lets the bird loose.
Oh my gosh.
I think I must have seen those episodes, but I didn't recognize him at the time. So I'm going to have to go back and check those out. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I'm glad that you brought the name up because I'm like, it's killing me not remembering. But
just the name itself conjures a very specific image.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the production backstory of this here film. I did try to streamline a lot of this. Obviously, with newer films, there's just so much out there you could read into it. But in 2006, this movie started when the screenwriter Travis Beecham, apparently he was walking down the beach in Santa Monica, and he looked out in the ocean, and he envisioned a giant robot and a monster fighting each other in the fog. And he then thought of the idea of that, okay, maybe these giant robots are piloted by 2 crew members, but then what if one of them died? So that's how he started to kick around a story about loss and survivor's guilt. He wrote a 25-page spec script, sold it to Universal, and that's when Del Toro comes on board, kind of. This was in 2010. 4 years has gone by. Del Toro's planning to direct At the Mountains of Madness, an H.P. Lovecraft story that various directors, I think even John Carpenter, has tried to make this movie. Clearly, nobody's made it yet. Are you guys familiar with the story At the Mountains of Madness?
No.
Vaguely.
It's about explorers, adventurers in the South Pole, and they go into a cave, and they come upon the ruins of an ancient civilization, and there are monsters lurking within. So it's right up Del Toro's alley. But he had this project fall through, ultimately. He wouldn't compromise on a budget and R rating. So then he signed on to direct Pacific Rim, because before this, he was just agreeing to produce and co-write Pacific Rim. But Mountains of Madness fell through, and he's like, all right, I'll do Giant Kaiju instead.
I can take over here just for the next couple bullet points. So then Del Toro and Beecham spent a year on the screenplay, fleshing out ideas like what would a kaiju birth look like, kaiju perspective from a little child, a very memorable flashback in the movie. The story, which, you know, Beecham initially conceived as one of loss, moving on, survivor's guilt, those themes kind of deepened throughout their collaboration. Del Toro wanted the film to be operatic and romantic, embracing certain character archetypes. So filming took place from November 2011 to April 2012 in Toronto at Pinewood Studios. It was shot in 103 days. A lot of different directors are sort of given thanks at the end of the film. James Cameron, I know, is one of them, as well as some of Del Toro's influences, like Ishiro Honda, Ray Harryhausen, I believe, as well. David Cronenberg also is thanked in the end credits. He helped out with lending a lot of the crew for the film and putting the crew together, since he's a Toronto native.
That's awesome. I didn't even realize that.
No, neither did I. I was like, whoa, this is like...
All-star lineup of director influences.
Yeah. Then I was thinking about James Cameron. I was like, man, he is also a master of his own craft with monster movies and things too. Like, Big Mecha?
Just any kind of robot, yeah.
Yeah, maybe a little one here and there.
Terminator, Alita, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so good company.
So Del Toro wanted to honor the kaiju and mecha genres while creating an original standalone film. He states he wanted to be conscious of the heritage, but not a pastiche or an homage or a greatest hits of everything. I don't want it to be postmodern, referential, or just belong to a genre. I really wanted to create something new, something madly in love with those things. And he does. He really does. I tried to bring epic beauty to it and drama and operatic grandeur, kind of like what you mentioned earlier. He also drew inspiration from a number of media, like paintings such as Francisco Goya's The Colossus, Hokusai's The Great Wave of Kanagawa, and early sci-fi series like The Thunderbirds, you know, the 1964 puppet show. He also delineates between more animalistic kaiju designs, reptiles, bugs, you know, giant gorilla, and more outlandish kaiju designs. The kaiju in Pacific Rim, especially the early ones, were designed in the Nakajima style, meaning they look like traditional man in suit kaiju, which that makes a lot of sense, especially Knifehead. Oh my goodness, Knifehead. Yeah. Del Toro praises the animation work in the film, which is blended with practical effects and constructed sets. He chose animation over mocap.
Yeah, he openly credits the suit actor Haruo Nakajima, who played Godzilla and so many other famous kaiju in the Showa era. And he says that he calls it, quote, the Nakajima style, to design these creatures as if it were someone inside in that same aesthetic.
It works, because honestly, you would definitely think it kind of makes me feel like the way I felt watching Shin Godzilla a little bit, thinking that there was actually somebody there.
Yeah.
And that is just a detail to me, guys, that if you're not a fan of like Showa era kaiju movies, you may not even know who Nakajima is. You wouldn't. And you wouldn't. So like, you wouldn't bring that prior knowledge into your decision making. It's only because he's a fan. He's like, oh yeah, let's make it look like Haruo Nakajima. I just love that. I don't know what else to say.
There's also a fight where one of the Jaegers is like fighting a kaiju, and I wish I remembered the names of the kaiju and the Jaeger, but I don't. But like, I feel like the Jaeger is like pulling the mouth apart and then like rips something out of the kaiju, and they like cut away, maybe because that would be a little bit too violent for this movie. But to me, that is just always going to go back to King Kong and, you know, King Kong like breaking the dinosaur's jaw. I feel like maybe that was an homage to that moment as well, but
probably.
I could be wrong about that.
There's everything. I mean, even the... when the Jaeger and Ohachi, the Swiss Army knife of a kaiju who flies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they go up into space and the Jaeger pulls the sword. I mean, we have seen that in the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers movie.
Yep.
And Robot Jocks, to just name two others on this podcast we've covered.
Good point. Yeah. That is a solid motif. It's such a cool moment in this movie. I love it.
So cool. Yeah. A hallmark of the genre.
Yeah.
All that to say, I mean, this movie was then released in July of 2013. You guys were there in the premiere, at the premiere in Mexico City, right?
I wish.
Sir, I've barely been outside of Florida.
It was released in the US later that month. So-so box office in the United States. Much more of its gross came from the world box office. Forbes even said, quote, the rare English language film in history to cross 400 million while barely crossing 100 million domestic. So kind of like a unusual dynamic there. Critical praise was largely positive, but some pretty scathing reviews. Well, you can look them up. They were just like really long too. Like some critics just went on a diatribe, mostly about like the human drama, the casting of the film. To me, and I can link to these reviews too. To me, it seems like these reviewers just like they're not, they don't get it. You know what I mean? Like, I'll try to be a little more specific. Like, they don't understand the inner workings of a genre movie like this. Like, we just identified this motif of going into space with a sword. And we know when it's done well, Pacific Rim, and when it's not done well, Robot Jocks.
Whoa, what a callback. Hey. How dare you?
But like a mainstream quote-unquote critic isn't going to necessarily have that same knowledge. You know what I mean?
Right.
I do. And also, I will save this for the good, the bad, and the campy at the end, but perhaps some of those scathing reviews might have one or two points. I'm sorry to say it. I'll elaborate more on that later in the episode. Sorry.
It's a throwdown.
All right, so I just need your address.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, Sean, don't jump through the screen and, like, strangle me right now, but...
I'm too lazy. That won't happen.
That's good.
No, actually, no, Matt, you're good. I'll draw another comp with, like, Shape of Water, which, you know, I'm not going to get into, like, the details of reviewing that movie, but when it came out, you know, you heard a lot of people talk about, oh, that's, like, the movie about having sex with a fish man. And it's like, well, it's more than that. It's a serious movie. So that's what I mean. Like, people may be writing it off because, oh, it's just a dumb monster movie.
Like you said, they don't understand genre types.
Yeah. But yeah. Are there flaws? Yes, I will even admit to that. Maybe. I don't know, Matt. I don't know. You got to convince me.
Yeah, no, that's fair. But it's a very valid point. It's a genre movie, genre elements, and critics probably should do a better job, some critics, of paying attention to that, you know?
Some legacy for this film. There's a thing called the Mako Mori test, like the Bechdel test. I actually wasn't familiar with that, but if you look it up, it's a thing. It is a set of criteria used to evaluate a film's portrayal of women, named after the character Mako Mori in Pacific Rim. The subsequent sequel, which we've talked about, and a Netflix anime, Pacific Rim The Black, which ran for a couple seasons.
Yes, it did.
So there's some legacy for this film. I think fans want there to be more.
So just to add into that real quick, there is more. There are multiple comics. They actually, a couple years ago, Kickstarter ended up making this giant anthology graphic novel series that I have as a giant box set, which I will probably show you at the end. But it's huge, and it's basically all different stories that you would see throughout the Pacific Rim universe. And then they just finished greenlighting a second thing, where it's basically the not unwritten at this point, but the unfilmed script that was supposed to be Pacific Rim 3.
Mm.
So,
cool.
I'm excited.
That's cool. Yeah. Awesome. And of course, Pacific Rim is under Legendary Pictures, Warner Brothers. Same as the MonsterVerse movies of Godzilla. So in theory, a crossover could happen. Like, that would just be a dream come true. Unfortunately, I don't think Pacific Rim had that kind of box office to warrant that kind of venture. But man, Godzilla versus these mechs, it'd be perfect. It's happened before with, like, you know, Mecha Godzilla and things like that.
Oh, that reminds me. So, Matt, you brought up Ultraman. There is a Godzilla character that's like Ultraman that is considered a mech.
Hmm.
I see Vincent nodding, so he knows exactly who it is.
I didn't know it was considered a mech. Maybe we're not thinking of the same monster.
Oh, wait. So he's considered a mech in one of their anime shows. I don't know if he's actually considered a mech in the movies.
Oh, okay.
What's that? Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, I know Vincent knows who I'm talking about.
Well, I don't know. Who is it?
Oh, God. Why'd you put me on the spot here? I shouldn't have said that anything.
You're our resident mecha expert.
Yeah, but I'm not the Godzilla guy.
But I'm not the Ultraman guy. Well, there's GRS.
No.
GRS, who is, they stuck a, like a big frill on a Godzilla costume and called it a day, which is hilarious.
I'm going to remember it in a little bit. Just go on. I'm sorry.
Okay.
The only one I can think of is Mechagodzilla, but I feel like that does not really count very much. Not for what we're talking about.
Jet Jaguar.
Oh. Yeah. Love Jet Jaguar. Ultraman knockoff.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do I know Jet Jaguar? What Godzilla movies was he in?
Godzilla versus Megalon. Which we haven't talked about, but maybe you've seen it on your own.
I don't think I have. All right, add that to the list. Maybe it'll be on the holiday preview episode.
Whoa! Don't tease me with a good time. That movie is a good time. It's a blast.
Cool. We'll check it out.
Okay. Well, perfect time for our sponsor break. Camp Kaiju is brought to you by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Whether you're looking for your dream home, a savvy investment property, or expert guidance in home rehab and flipping, the Zach Pack has you covered. Check the link in the show notes for more information. Guys, Mina's mailbox is busting these days. I've got two comments for us.
Ooh.
One from Superfan Don, now on Patreon, about the giant spider invasion.
Superfan Don says, "This was quite an interesting film, but I knew I was going to have fun. A few seconds after the opening credits, there he is, Alan Hale himself. And the first words out of his mouth are, 'Hi, little buddy. How can you not love that?' When they mentioned the Neutron Initiator, all I could think of was, 'Reverse the polarity in the neutron flow,' from Doctor Who. But a lot of people wouldn't get that reference. I admit, Don, I am one of them." Don goes on to say, "Definitely an enjoyable movie. I'm curious what the updated anniversary version will be like. I hope one or both of you guys are able to see it and tell us about it." I hope so as well. Thank you, Don. Good to see your comment. Yeah, Giant Spider Invasion, a very fun movie, and I too cannot wait to see what the new footage looks like that Bill Rabane shot for it.
Agreed. And check it out. So bad it's good. And then Kaiju Nick, we have another fan of the show. He writes in response to Phantom of the Opera. This was via our website, campkaijupodcast.com. And Kaiju Nick says, "Well done, Camp Kaiju, on your Phantom of the Opera centennial celebration. Don't forget, this year is also the 100th anniversary of The Lost World. I think this is the first feature-length film with Willis O'Brien's stop-motion effects. There are earlier examples, but they're all short films." Kaiju Nick, thank you for bringing that to our attention. 1925, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World is adapted for the screen. It's Willis O'Brien who went on to do King Kong and influence the entire genre that leads to Pacific Rim. But The Lost World is also celebrating 100 years. I think that movie holds up. It's in the public domain, obviously. Go check it out for yourself. But it is a great time with dinosaurs. And the final action piece of that movie is dinosaurs are brought back to New York City, break their chains, and run amok. So it's great.
Are you sure you're not talking about Jurassic Park, The Lost World? That sounds almost similar.
You know, I think you might be right. I think that is also featuring its 100th anniversary.
Special effects are amazing for 1925 in that movie. I don't know what Spielberg did.
Time travelers, yo.
Yeah.
All right. Peter Lorre, he's been on a wild ride, guys. He has been, he's in a room next to me. He's been talking, I think, to a raven, some kind of bird is cawing to him, and he is reciting the poem, The Raven. There's some weird things happening. I try not to ask. I let him do his thing.
Wait. Is the raven calling the raven to him?
To be determined. No, no.
I need to hear this.
I'm clear.
Maybe it's not Peter who's going mad, but Vincent.
Oh, don't put that on me. Maybe
he's going stark raven mad, right?
Oh, I like that.
What? What is this madness you speak of? Did Peter Lorre ever exist, or was it always me? I can't tell anymore.
So many plot twists in this episode.
Are you the you that's really you?
Well. Peter Lorre is going to talk about a 1944 picture called Crazy Nights. And our letterbox synopsis reads, three crack-brained clowns trapped in a haunted house with a runaway gorilla. Oh, my God. Also known as Ghost Crazy, three goofballs run up against ghosts and a giant gorilla in a haunted house with Shemp Howard of the Three Stooges.
Oh, does it only have Shemp or are the other Three Stooges in it as well?
I think it's just Shemp.
Weird. Okay.
The good one.
That's the weirdest thing, Matt, you took from that synopsis?
Not the crack brain clowns.
Good point. I'm so used to these, like, you know, weird old kaiju movie, or not kaiju, but this monster movie synopses. It's like, yeah, that sounds about right. That's not surprising to me. Shemp Howard, what's going on here? That's where I'm at with monster movies these days.
You can only handle so much weird until it becomes normal.
Yeah, exactly.
That's also going on a tote bag.
Oh, I love it.
Welcome to the Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood. Yes, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets they dripped with blood. Together we will watch the best of the worst. Movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances. But with enough haunted houses, ape men, devil bats, and zombies to keep you up at night, this is the Poverty Row Picture Show, and I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. It has been quite a doozy here, though I am dead. It appears I cannot entirely shuffle off the mortal coils that remind me of my humanity. Well, what would I do without my raven friend? Yes, my lovely lady friend. Oh, well, let me apologize that I have not watched Ghost Crazy, otherwise known as Crazy Nights, with Shemp Howard, one of three of the Three Stooges. Well, looks like I will be saving this one for the new year. Ring-a-ding, baby. In my time, I have yet to finish The Raven. My friends, something might happen at the end of this. You just wait and see. This, I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er. But whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, nevermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer swung by seraphim whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by the angels he hath sent thee, respite and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh, quaff this kind nepenthe and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter set or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted on this desert land, enchanted on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore, quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden if, within the distant Aden, it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Clasp a rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. B. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked, upstarting. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door. Quote the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of palace just above my chamber door. And her eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming. And the lamplight door her streaming throws her shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore. Oh my golly gee willikers, friends, look at this blinding light. Oh, something's happening in the radiance of the beaming light of the raven. She is transforming into a long-haired beauty. Oh my goodness, it is Lenore. Lenore, how long it has been. Oh, you were the raven the whole time. Oh my goodness, come here. Let me embrace you. Oh, let me kiss your sweet lips. Yes, it is your Peter Lorre. Yes, never mind my rotted corpse. I am still the strong, svelte, handsome actor you have always known. Oh, yes, Lenore. Well, what shall we do now? Yes, I agree. We should take a vacation from this podcast. We should go somewhere warm. But listeners, I will return in the new year, in 2026, the Poverty Row Picture Show, in Shemp Howard. We will return.
True terror is the soft, cold caress of the raven's wing.
Ooh. Your hands are so cold.
A woman whose desires transcend reality. The mysterious powers of black magic, these you will explore.
Now, what is it you need? You got some dried blood or from bat in the house?
Help! Help! The raven will take you careening through the darkest of dangers. Help! Into the ominous mystery of a master magician's evil castle.
Afraid, my dear? I offer you a choice. The secret of your hand manipulations, or this against this.
Well, don't just stand there.
Do something.
Let's break down Pacific Rim, the good, the bad, and the campy. Let's start with the good.
You know, I'll just like very briefly say that I love the amount of visual imagination and detail that Guillermo del Toro and his crew put into seemingly every shot or scene of this movie. One of my favorite examples is in the middle of a kaiju versus Jaeger fight, we're like in the middle of a building that's being totally demolished and the camera, you know, pans over to the Newton balls, like the little metal balls that keep on going back and forth. That's a good touch. I just want to leave it there. I feel like, Sean, you should lay. This is you're in the spotlight. This is your time to shine.
How dare you, sir? I expected more.
All right. There are other things I like about it, but I feel like, yeah, you could say it better.
So if we're going to go with individual breakdowns here real quick, mech designs being number one, every single mech has its own unique personality to it. You've got Gypsy Danger, where it's just giant blue Hulk with a giant middle piece that's just a giant thruster, or a nuclear reactor, so to speak. You've got the Chinese brother trio, where they actually have the three arms, and they try to do the three-arm technique. You've got the Russian duo. I think they're called Chernobyl. you could see that they were basically just to be a giant tank, and they were supposed to be the frontline defense. Striker Eureka, who, if anybody's ever played the Metal Gear Solid franchise, Striker Eureka was also designed by the Metal Gear designer, Yoji Shinkawa, and you can see the way how his art translates from the game to that. Just the mech designs all around, fantastic. The kaiju, again, every single one is so different from each other, until you get to the end, where the final three kind of blend together for me, but up until that point, every single one, they're all unique, they're all different, and you can tell the level of aggression in each and every single one. It's just so good. And then lastly, Idris Elba. That's it.
Yeah. What an actor. Like, did he, all he has to do is, like, walk into the frame, and you're like, I'm paying attention. I want to see what this guy does, you know? Like, he just has that natural movie star charisma.
Mm-hmm.
So grounded. So much power.
Don't ever touch me.
Yeah, that was so good. I loved, agreed with the Jaegers. I'll add the Gypsy Danger, or like in the beginning, Del Toro's shooting a lot of things, and the costuming is all designed like a World War II aesthetic. Bomber jackets, the hangars are kind of modeled after manufacturing plants from that era. Well, even Gypsy Danger is like evoking those fighter planes from the time period. I love this movie. Yeah, Matt, it's so technically savvy. And it helped that I had Del Toro in my ear telling me what to look for. But there's so much depth in his shots, which adds this just layer of realness. Initially, he did not film this movie with 3D technology. He did convert it to 3D later. But you still get that sense that he said 3D wouldn't really enhance my movie because everything is already layered. Mm-hmm. So you got things in the foreground, you got things in the background. Every inch of the screen is filled with detail, which is just so beautiful. And another technical aspect I really love now that I pay attention to it is his use of lighting. So, for example, in one of the Jaeger kaiju fights, which all mostly happen at night, which can be a problem to some with your monster movies because you can't really see what's happening. I think he uses nighttime shots effectively and creatively. Because there's a scene, I forget who's fighting who, but the monsters and the Jaeger are lit by the helicopters whirring above. So it's mm-hmm. the beams of the helicopters. It's just like creative ways to light a scene like that.
It's funny that you bring up the nighttime shot because, yeah, most of the fights in this are nighttime. And then when you watch movies like Transformers where they do their nighttime shots, and those generally... Wait, is it nighttime? Yeah, nighttime tends to look better in those movies. It's usually the daytime shots where they just look like CGI blobs.
Oh,
it's
interesting.
It's really, really messy watching daytime shots. And then if you end up watching the second movie, somehow they manage to actually get it to work. So I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah. Well, maybe it doesn't matter what you do, as long as you do it well. Mm-hmm. If you don't do it well, it doesn't matter.
Ill will.
Yeah. One thing that I would add to the good category for me, if I can add one more thing real quick, is just, you know, the movie was shot digitally, I think, with like Epic Red cameras. I forget exactly what kind of cameras they use, but I mean, it looks phenomenal. Like the colors are just like so bright and saturated and beautiful, especially in the Hong Kong scenes. I know Del Toro said something about how like he just wanted insanely saturated colors in those scenes. And I think the digital photography, cinematography really, you know, creates that sort of vibrant aesthetic. And I tend to be kind of a hater with digital cinematography. Like, you know, shoot on film, 35 millimeter always looks so beautiful. I tend to be a little stubborn about that. But this movie proves me wrong in that way. And it's kind of, you know, it goes back to what you just said, Vincent. Like, it doesn't really matter exactly what you do as long as you do it well. And they use the technology, both Del Toro and the cinematographer Navarro, to create this really distinct aesthetic. And yeah, it's just a really unique look. So definitely in the good category for me in this movie.
Yeah. And I didn't realize how much of this movie is actually practical. Like the sets, they're on real sets. And for example, the flashback to Mako Mori and she's the little girl. Obviously, the kaiju is computer rendered, but on the ground, there are puddles of water that shake and vibrate with each footfall. That's all practical. So it's giving the actor something to act off of. And like that doesn't really happen these days. Like it would just all be digitally rendered.
Marvel.
Yeah, right. But that commitment to it, maybe it's like Jurassic Park, right? We're combining the tools. And I think that's the best way to use computer graphics, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Yeah, that's cool. I've said a lot of good things already throughout this episode, so I'll keep it at that. All right. But bad things, Matt, this is going to be your time to shine.
Oh, man. Once again, I'm very worried about offending Sean. Let me just say, I like this movie. There's a lot to love about this movie, so take what I say with a grain of salt. But, you know, I do think the nighttime and, like, a lot of, like, rain, you know, like a moving camera, I do think it's kind of hard to, like, really get a good look at how distinct the kaijus and the Jaegers really are. And I do think, like, the design is creative, but you never really get a good look at them. And, like, I would be hard-pressed to, like, tell one kaiju apart from another in this movie for that reason. And so, yeah, that's part of it for me. I think maybe a more significant hindrance for me or frustration is like the thinness of the characters' backstories. And like, I'm kind of contradicting myself because I said before that Del Toro is a humanist director who loves his characters, and I think that's true. But I think the characters in this movie can be defined in like one word, you know, like grief, trauma, redemption, underdog. Like, that's the level of depth to these characters. And sometimes it kind of seems like a screenwriting seminar in movie form where it's like, at this exact moment, like, there needs to be a moment of doubt. But then at this exact moment, they're going to, like, come in and save the day at the last moment. And, you know, it's formula. I get that. And it's a genre movie. It goes back to what we were talking about before. I actually read an interview with Del Toro where he was talking about how he cut an hour of content from the movie. Like, he removed a lot of the character dynamics and backstories to focus more on, like, the kaiju stuff, the genre stuff. And he even had a quote where he's like, this isn't Ibsen. Like, we're not supposed to be, like, you know, dwelling in, like, these deep, complex characters. And I do get that. But for me, it's like, they don't even really register as human beings. They're kind of like cogs in a machine until we get to the kaiju versus Jaeger fights. And I really do want more of that human subtext. It's a fun movie, but I feel like there could be more depth to it. It's a trade-off. If you add more of that character depth, maybe you do get a little bit less of just that pure kaiju genre fun. But yeah, the characters don't do it for me. I think a lot of the dialogue is, you know, very basic. And that's kind of putting it kindly, in my opinion. So yeah, the human element could be more in this movie.
That's fair.
Totally.
Completely disagree, yeah. But that's fair.
And I know, yeah, I feel the need to apologize. I'm sorry.
You don't need to apologize, but I will hunt you down.
Come on, we have this conversation, yeah. Though, and it's valid with every kaiju movie. And that's not to undercut, Matt, what you're saying. It's a legitimate criticism of almost every movie we've watched.
A lot of them, yeah.
A lot of kaiju-based movies, like, oh, give me less humans. And there is a stretch that I think we don't have a lot of giant monster battles. I think there's a good stretch of this movie that is human drama. Mm-hmm. Does it drag? I'll leave that for other people to debate. What's that other hour missing from this movie? What's the director's cut, the original? I would be into that. I would be into knowing, having these characters fleshed out more. Yeah.
Well, Vincent, you got to read the comics in order to find out.
But I can't read. I watch movies.
That explains so much. I should
How
read
did
the comics.
I not know this. I guess the only bad for me, because, you know, can't really say anything bad on my end. The only bad for me is that, again, there aren't that many kaiju mecha fights, as Vincent said. I wish there were more. I'm glad that we do get to see more during those, like, newscasts, and you actually get to see, like, little snippets of the battles here and there. But obviously, I want more. I want more of that spectacle. But to counter something that Matt said, at least these human characters, despite them being live-action anime archetypes, they're still better than the human characters in any Transformer movie combined.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, yeah.
Last thing I'll say, though, well, like, a criticism of mine that actually kept coming up was, I feel like, and this is the very thin line I think Del Toro is writing in making such a pastiche, really. I mean, he's not calling it pastiche, but it is to a certain extent. And okay, if you're gonna fill your cast with these strong jawed, like, blonde machismo characters, they also kind of blend together. Like, the acting is fine, but it's the casting where Charlie Hunnam and his Australian counterparts, they just look like carbon copies of each other. They're just these blonde, strong men. And I'm like, I would like to see a little more diversity with them, because they just blend together. Not to say this movie is not diverse. There is a lot of diversity in the movie and behind the camera too, obviously. But there was still an aspect where I was like, there's a lot of, there's just a lot of men who look the same in this movie.
Well, they solved that with the second movie. I'm just saying.
They do. Yeah. Yeah.
I do think the Mako character is kind of like inconsistent for me. I like her a lot, and I like the actress Rinko Kikuchi, right? Is that her name?
Yes.
I really like the scene where, like, she and Charlie Hunnam, like, battle in that, like, training sequence. I love that moment. But then, you know, when they're in the Jaeger, she doesn't really do anything. Like, it's always Charlie Hunnam. It's like, all right, just, like, here's what you do with the drift, you know? Like, here, do this. Like, get ready with this elbow rocket. Do this. And she's kind of just along for the ride. So I like her character, but I wish she did more in the Jaeger, because she's kind of... I don't really buy that she's this, like, great natural fighter, because it's, yeah, in those moments, I'm not really buying it.
But she announced the sword.
Yeah, that's true. That is her one. Yeah, that's a cool moment. You got me on that.
We could talk about some fun moments and then wrap it up with our final takes on the film.
There's a lot of camp. There's so much camp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the end, especially, like, he ramps it up.
Top three are the tanker scene.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
That's just so bonkers. Obviously the sword, you know, calling it out.
Yes.
And then, hey, let's check to see if it still has a pulse.
Yeah.
So good. So campy. So good.
It's great when they go inside the baby kaiju, or no, it's the real kaiju, and then the baby is birthed from this sack,
and
like that
eats Ron Perlman.
yep.
But then the, like, mid-credits, like, you know, surprise appearance from Ron Perlman, like, that's a very campy moment. That's mm-hmm. a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Oh shoot, I keep losing my place. It's almost too on the nose where I think it is campy. Where each of the Jaegers are stereotypically their nations, like the Chinese dragon and the poor Russians, like, they're Ivan Drago's. They're in a Cold War era tank. It's like, you know, if I was a Russian today, I'd be like, can we get past that image of us, please?
So <Yeah. laughs> I think, and I don't know if he actually talks about that in the commentary, but I think he may have borrowed that from an anime called G Gundam, which is basically their Dragon Ball Z version of Gundam, where it's basically different nations fighting for control over resources. And
Robot Jacks?
Basically. And the weird part is that every single one is built to represent their nation in a specific way, and it can be incredibly offensive.
I can, like, see how that would.
The Mexican one has a sombrero, so. Yeah, and I think Sweden is a giant windmill Gundam. So.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you might want to look that one up.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So at least Del Toro, like, had a little as much taste as he could. He wasn't going to go sombrero level. Mexican that he is, though. I don't know. All right. Yeah. Funny stuff.
I feel like some of the campiest moments are like the lines that Sean said before, like, we're canceling the apocalypse, you know, like, you know, the world is ending. Where do you want to be? Here or in a Jaeger? Like that stuff, all that stuff is the height of camp in a very entertaining way.
Yeah.
Ooh. Okay. So then quick question. Who do you think has the better speech? Stacker Pentecost or the president from Independence Day?
I think the better speech is Independence Day because it's longer. It has more of a journey. Pentecost's speech is actually quite short, I feel like. Mm-hmm. But Idris Elba delivers it just so impactfully more than Bill Pullman delivers his.
I like that he meanders at the beginning where he's not entirely sure what he wants to say because he ends up repeating himself before he ends up actually diving into it.
Yeah.
True.
I would give the nod to Independence Day. Sorry.
Okay.
Sean's going to hate me by the end of this episode.
No, that can't happen. Not yet.
Thank you. It's only a matter of time. All right, so as usual on Camp Kaiju, we have four ratings. Our highest rating is it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time.
I think this movie is a classic of the genre. I think it does stand the test of time. It's relatively recent, but I think it redefines what's possible with this genre in terms of visual effects, storytelling, and breathing new life into it. I think more people should see it, honestly. I mean, fans outside of the genre, if you're listening, good for you. Go watch this movie because I think it does stand the test of time and offers a lot of great humor. However cardboard the characters may be, at the end of the day, I think the monster fights are awesome.
Nice. I feel like maybe I should go next just so we can end the episode on like an extremely positive note. And because Sean, you're the guest star and I feel like you should have the last word. Does that sound all right?
I was going to try to see if I could go next just so I could try to win you over, but no, it's all right.
Oh.
Well, I don't know if that's going to happen. I'm sorry, Sean. If anybody could do it, I think you could. But I don't know. I'm sorry. For me, it does not stand the test of time. It is fun. This movie is fun. I think in some ways, maybe it is historically significant because the special effects are very impressive. Again, visually, it's a very just immersive, imaginative movie. I would like to see more of the kaijus and the Jaegers. I would like the human characters to have more depth. I would like there to be a little bit more originality in the story, which to me is all kind of like surface level plot mechanics. So yeah, I'm, you know, trying to play devil's advocate maybe here a little bit, but for me, this movie does not stand the test of time. It is very fun and people should see it. So I agree with you there.
I appreciate your candor.
Sorry.
It's all right. I think we all know where I stand with this one, but I'm going to lead in a little bit. I don't find this movie offensive in any way whatsoever. Granted, there are some stereotypes, but it's not a movie where you can put it on and somebody be, wow, this is trash. Why am I watching this? Because everything just disgusts me. No, I don't see that happening. I think it could be a little slow, you know, to some people, because I did try watching it with one person and they didn't like it because they thought it was going to be incredibly serious rather than having its goofy moments. But as we've learned and have discussed, there are people who don't like specific genre types or don't understand it. That being said, it still holds up as one of those movies where, despite it being cookie cutter in terms of plot and character, I think it still manages to get everything across really well. I think visually it is outstanding. Again, mechs, kaiju. Everything about it's just phenomenal. So that being said, I'm going to give it the lowest rating. No, I'm kidding. It is a timeless classic. Definitely stands the test of time.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. And everything we've said from all three of us is accurate. So yeah, I would love to hear more people's thoughts on this movie. But let us, and the, yeah, thanks.
Can
for
I make a
out,
recommendation for people?
Yeah.
So there is the voicemail number that you guys have here. I would like it if somebody would call in either as Raleigh Beckett or as Stacker Pentecost and leave a voicemail using your best impression of either Idris Elba or Raleigh Beckett.
There you go. That's a great folks. Idea. Don't let Sean down.
I was a little worried for a second you were going to give my personal number and tell people to like tell me why I'm wrong. I'm glad you didn't do that.
No. I have a little bit of professionalism.
John, tell the people more about Big Mecha But Not Huge Again and where they can find you and follow your podcast.
Yes, so you can find us on both on Spotify, YouTube, and I think also on Apple Podcasts. It's called Big Mecha But Not Huge. You will see a giant picture of a factory holding this giant. It just looks like a giant piece. I can't really describe it because that would be NSFW. But it's yeah, mecha. But anyways, you can find it on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Right now, season 2 is just about to finish. We're working on season 3. Vincent's going to be on there as a guest. We also have other Sean Pryor. We also call him Other Sean on there. He shows up too. So yeah, it's a fun time. And also check out Toku for 2.
Yeah, definitely. Sean, this was a blast. Thanks for coming on, bud. We'll Absolutely. See you next week for the holiday party. And... We'll share with you what we got lined up for 2026.
Awesome. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sean. It's always a pleasure. I will make up my middling review of Pacific Rim to you someday, I promise.
I'm going to wear a t-shirt the next time I show up, and it's going to say Matt was wrong.
I love it. I feel like I should get one of those shirts. Because that's usually accurate. I am wrong a lot of the time.
No. I can't say that because it's some of the things I do agree with, but no, not on this one.
Yeah, totally. It's the beauty of subjective opinions, you know?
Thank you, Sean. We'll let you get out of here. Me and Matt will talk about you behind your back when you leave.
That's cool. I already stink. It's fine.
Thanks for hanging out with us, friends. Please rate and review the show and follow us on patreon.com/campkaiju for additional videos, reviews, merchandise, and more. Other ways to get in touch, email at campkaiju@gmail.com, our website, campkaijupodcast.com, on Instagram, or our voicemail number is 612-470-2612. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Mina's Mailbox music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is brought to you by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Whether you're looking for your dream home, a savvy investment property, or expert guidance in home rehab and flipping, the Zach Pack has you covered. Don't forget to follow the Zach Pack on social media for the latest updates and insights.
In less than an hour, aircraft from here will join others from around the world. And you will be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind. Mankind, that word should have new meaning for all of us today. We can't be consumed by our petty differences anymore. We will be united in our common interest. Perhaps it's fate that today is the 4th of July. And you will once again be fighting for our freedom. Not from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from annihilation. We're fighting for our right to live, to exist. And should we win the day, the 4th of July will no longer be known as an American holiday, but as the day when the world declared in one voice, we will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. We're going to live on. We're going to survive. Today, we celebrate our Independence Day.
Everyone, listen up. Today, at the edge of our hope, at the end of our time, we have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today, there's not a man nor woman in here that shall stand alone. Not today. Today, we face the monsters that are at our door and bring the fight to them. Today, we are canceling the apocalypse.